you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Welcome to Kotaku Split Screen, the only video game podcast that is both a robot and a dinosaur. It's April 13th, 2017, and we've got a great show for you this week. We're going to start out talking about the news of the week. PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds sells 1 million copies, even though Jason and I both haven't played it. Star Wars Battlefront 2 trailer leaks, and Xbox Scorpio's specs are released. After that, we will be joined by the one and only Ashley Birch, writer and voice actor extraordinaire, most recently the star of the PS4 game Horizon Zero Dawn. Then we'll read some listener mail and talk a little bit more about how games are like music and architecture and Star Wars movies, and whether changing games after they come out is bad for the industry. And here we are for another episode of Kotaku Split Screen. My name is Kirk Hamilton. I am editor-at-large at Kotaku.com. I am joined, as always, by Kotaku news editor Jason Schreier from the comfort of his apartment. Hi, Jason. How are you doing?
Hi, Kirk. So what does it mean to be editor-at-large? Does that just mean you can do anything you want? Isn't that the title that just means, like, I can do whatever what I want?
I think
today.
There is an under... I looked up what it meant when I was changing titles to find out what exactly title I should have. And
yeah.
I think that there is a technical... Like, jokes about being chased by the police and stuff aside, there is a technical description, which basically means an editor who sometimes edits people and generally is responsible for his or her own, like, editorial, you know, choices and just writes whatever, which is basically what I do. So it's an accurate title.
Minus the editing people, because you don't really
I
edit
I do edit people.
People.
No, I edit Dr. Nerdlove. I edit Steven. I edit some of our staffers from time to time. People will kick me articles at it. So I still do some editing.
All
not
right,
as
so
much
that's
as
an accurate
to.
An accurate description of your work at Kotaku.
It sums it up.
This has been another episode of Kotaku Inside Baseball with Kirk and Jason.
Of what titles mean. Titles, what are they? Do they mean things?
Let's titles, find out. What are they? Do they mean things? Let's find out. So, Kirk, did you have a good Passover?
I did. I had a really nice Passover. I actually ate.
Have you ever
some...
been to a Passover Seder?
I haven't. And I went to, Emily and I went to friends for dinner last night, and it was not a Seder. We had regular bread. Our host made some bread that was very good, but then we realized, oh, we're definitely eating leavened bread. So there you go.
Thank you for telling me that. That was good information.
So, yeah, sorry. I completely
so wait a minute. When your host, you like thought, you had the active thought, we're eating leavened bread right now?
Yeah, it was because we were all sitting around and we were...
So you were talking about how it's a Seder.
And we were having a dinner together and we were aware that it was Passover.
But
none of us are Jewish or practice that religion. Okay. And so we then realized, oh, well, this isn't really a Passover dinner because here we are eating this delicious focaccia that our host made.
So let me tell you a funny thing about the Passover Seder. And this one is for all the brethren listening, all of my fellow Jews listening. Mm-hmm. So the Passover Seder, the way it's traditionally done is you read from this book called a Haggadah. And basically it's in Hebrew, but you can also read it in English. And it tells the story of like Passover. Right, and it's this compilation of stuff. So it's a mixture of prayers, and then there's some stuff about like stuff from the Bible, Exodus stuff about the Jews leaving Egypt and the 10 plagues and all the Passover. I'm sure you have a vague recollection of the Passover story. So there are some random things in there. Like there's an entire section, and this is the funniest thing. Like I don't think non-Jews realize how much stupid shit is in Judaism. So there's an entire section in the Haggadah that you're supposed to read every Passover at the Seder that's just about three different rabbis having an argument over how many plagues there really were. And so one paragraph is like, this rabbi says, actually, there were 50 plagues because each each 10 plagues is analogized by one of God's fingers. And then another rabbi is like, actually, there are 200 plagues. And another rabbi is like, actually, there are 250 plagues. And this is an entire chunk of the Seder that you're supposed to read.
Do they ever agree on how many plagues
no,
there were?
No,
there's
a large part part of Judaism is never agreeing on anything.
Right, I was going to say, this is actually, from what I understand of Judaism, this is on brand.
You just have debates and ask questions and argue about things. So usually that can be interesting. And if you actually read, like, I've done some studying of, like, the Talmud back in high school and stuff. And sometimes it's, like, interesting arguments over, like, philosophical questions. But other times it's, like, how many plagues did God really smite upon Egypt? And it's the stupidest thing because it's, like, every year you read this story and some of the parts of the story are interesting and then there's this part and every year I try to convince my family to be like, all right, let's just skip this section.
Press X to skip this section.
Exactly.
Can we skip the percent of fast forward through this and get past it?
Yeah, but alas. Anyway, let's talk about video games, shall we?
Yeah, before the news, I think you and I both played a couple of interesting games that we
wanted
to really briefly
talk
about. I just updated, like, did a major update to our best PC VR games list, which was incredibly out of date. We had not updated it since we made it because we basically made it last April, and then just things changed so quickly, and new hardware kept coming out, and everything was different. So it was just like, okay, we're just going to wait to change this until it all settles down.
So
and
this
now
is
it's all settled
everything
down.
Except PlayStation VR.
Basically Oculus Rift and HTC Vive. It's like those two systems. So now, like, you know, they're pretty comparable in terms of hardware. Almost all games work on both. And so it was like, okay, it's time to update this thing. So I've been playing a bunch of VR games, and one of the games that I played out of curiosity was Rock Band VR, which came out a couple of weeks ago for Oculus Rift. This one is an actual Oculus Rift exclusive because Oculus funded the entire game and published the game, and Harmonix made it with them, and so it, like, works with the Oculus Touch controller in this really specific way. So basically, this game, I had it on my Oculus account, but I don't have any. You use a Rock Band guitar to play this game, and, you know, I don't know. Like, did you ever own like Rock Band?
I played Guitar Hero a lot in college.
Okay, so and so at some point, most people have had these instruments, and I love Rock Band, man.
Yeah,
in, like,
I had Guitar Hero too. Yeah.
And so I had all of them, and then I got rid of them. I don't know. I think when I moved to Portland, I was like, okay, it's time to just get rid of all this shit.
Everyone has gotten rid of their Rock Band instruments.
Right. And so you don't have any left, but then you need a guitar to play this game. It's not actually like Rock Band. It's just guitar, and you play in VR. Like, the basic gist is you're on stage and you're rocking out and you're, like, using a guitar, but you need a guitar, and I didn't have one. I was like, I'm not, like, gonna. And the Harmonix had kind of emailed us and been like, oh, you know, if you want to review it, like, we'll send you a guitar. And I'm like, I don't know if I'm going to review it. I don't even have time to play this, whatever. But then over the weekend, I kind of decided, you know, I'm going to play this. So I went to a used guitar game shop here. Not
a used
actually.
Guitar shop. You wouldn't find this
no.
at a used guitar
well,
shop.
Well, a used video game guitar shop called CD Game Exchange. It's like a really, it's cool because it's right on Hawthorne near where I live in Portland. And it is not a GameStop. So it's like an actual used game shop. Anyway, they had exactly one guitar and I bought it. And they made me buy a Xbox One copy of Rock Band 4 that came with it because they're just like, no, man, these are bundled. I have to sell this game. You have to buy it.
So
I was like, whatever.
How much is it?
He gave me a deal at $35.
Okay.
I think it was selling for $40. And I was like, I really don't want the game, man. And he was like, okay, I'll give it to you for $35. And actually, that's a pretty good deal.
It would have to be for next year, right?
Yeah, next year, tax write-off. Not a bad deal, actually. Those guitars still kind of go for, they're not like $10 on eBay or anything quite yet.
Okay.
So anyways, set it up. You kind of mount the Oculus Touch controller on the headstock of the guitar using this little dongle that came with it that's specific to Rock Band, which is really interesting and actually works really well. So then, because, you know, so it can track the controller, so then you're holding it in the game and it knows where your guitar is because the guitar can't really move. So you pick it up and you rotate it and move it around and the touch controller kind of tells you where it is. So then you play, and it's way simplified. You know, I wrote a whole article about this if you care about all the particulars. I kind of broke this down musically and how it does what it does. But you're kind of just, it's like guitar karaoke. You're kind of just strumming chord shapes to kind of well-known Rock Band songs while you're on stage with this band and you're looking around and, like, the audience is looking at you and your set list is taped to the floor. And it's really convincing. The details are all really cool. And then you can't fuck up. There's no note. There are no gems on a note bar coming toward you like in Rock Band. It goes from left to right and you just pick what chords you want. So you can do, like, open chord and then arpeggios and then power chords and then muted strings. And you can double up how fast you're strumming. And the guitar part
but
kind
the whole
of changes.
Fun of Guitar Hero is the is like like challenging yourself, isn't it?
Well, no. I mean, I actually don't think so. I think I have actually kind of burned out on that. Okay. And I think that that is the fun for a lot of people. And this game is very different than that. This is going for something different. It's much more just about performing. And there is a scoring system that's based around different combinations of chord shapes and sort of matching them and changing them up. But it's really mostly just about playing and having a good time and feeling like you're rocking out with a band, which is, I think, actually a really smart move. Partly just because I got kind of sick of the like really rigid scoring of Rock Band and Guitar Hero just over the years. That's never been why I like those games. I like the games because they kind of have, they like channel music in an interesting way. You know, one of my Rock Band story is basically that I never liked playing guitar, and I got really into playing drums in Rock Band. And that matches pretty closely to real drums. And then because of that, I was teaching jazz at the time, and I wound up filling in for a student on drum set because our drummer wasn't there. And I realized, oh, I've gotten a lot better at drums just from playing Rock Band. So I started practicing, and then I spent the next year practicing real drums. I got pretty good at drums, and then I stopped having fun playing drums in Rock Band because it's so restrictive, and you kind of have to follow the little dots, and you sure can't do things. So anyways, this is closer to actually playing, and it's okay, really fun. Nobody is going to play this game because it's a Rock Band game that's only available on Oculus Rift. So it's a niche within a niche. It's a very small thing, but it's super cool. And so if you have
hold on, does it work with any Guitar Hero controller, like you Rock need, Band controller?
Any Rock Band controller, and okay, I believe now that it does. I thought that it only worked with a set number, but I think that they told me. I believe they told me that it works with any. So PS3, Xbox 360, Xbox One, PS4. Mm-hmm. And you need the touch, Oculus Touch, to play it as well. Hmm. But it's cool. It's definitely a cool VR game compared to just shooting zombies or whatever.
It's interesting. It's interesting how VR is still in this place where it doesn't feel like anyone really cares about it except for the early adopters, like the hardcore fanatics.
Yeah, I mean, I think this game in particular is a really good example of what Oculus is trying to do and what Facebook is trying to do with Oculus, which is they've been funding all these games for the last year, either partially funding, and then you get these games that are these sort of exclusives, timed exclusives on the Oculus Store where you have to use this Revive thing to play them on Vive, or like in the case of Rock Band VR, they straight up just bankrolled that game. And so, you know, Harmonix, I'm guessing anyways, like, you know, employed people for a year and had a whole group of people on this project and got paid a bunch of money to make it and kind of stayed in business because, you know, if you've followed Harmonix over the last few years, they've been having hard times. And so it's cool that an independent studio was able to make this weird game that not that many people will play. I don't think it would have been profitable if they released it on its own, but it's like Oculus's kind of approach is we want to invest in VR, right? That's what they say. Uh-huh. We just want to make cool VR things so that this catches on.
Which is such a Silicon Valley like
Facebook. It's so, and who knows if that'll work. It's such a, we're just going to take a huge loss.
Unlimited amounts of cash. That doesn't even matter.
Jumpstart a whole industry. Yeah, it's a cool game though. If you even have the chance to like try it out, it's just worth. I mean, you could play for an hour.
Well, I'll come to your place and try it out next time.
Oh yeah, and also, when you're in Portland, you have to play it. And listeners, if you just know somebody with an Oculus Rift or have the opportunity,
if you're in Portland and you want to go to Kirk's place and try it out,
you want to swing by my place, and play it. You've been playing a game too, right?
Real quick, I'll talk about this more when I play more of it and finish it, but mm-hmm. I played a few hours of this game, Cosmic Star Heroine, which is a JRPG by Zoboid Games. You know who they are? They're the guys who made Breath of Death, Cthulhu Saves the World, and then
Cthulhu Saves the World. That's how I know that.
That was a fun one. Yeah, that was like an indie hit back in the Xbox Live indie games marketplace days. And they also made the Penny Arcade RPGs, the last two.
Right.
So yeah, this game is like their first real original big creation in a long time, and it's very ambitious and really cool, and it's like a sci-fi fantasy star spiritual successor, a lot of Chrono Trigger in there, apparently some Suikoden. In my 3 hours or 4 hours I spent with it, I am enjoying it quite a bit, even though it's a little buggy. It's got some issues, some finicky issues that they'll fix. I already saw the developer talking about issuing a patch, and I've been telling him some of the bugs that I found. So I'll talk more about this when I finish it, and I can more thoroughly recommend it because they didn't send out early codes or anything. So I just started playing it last night. But it's cool. It's if you're into sci-fi JRPGs and you want like a new fantasy star game, I recommend it.
There's probably a lot of people that applies to.
Yeah,
that makes me want to check it out though.
Yeah, dude, I think you would enjoy it. Check it out. On, I gave you a code for PS4. You should check it out.
The
cool thing about this game is that the combat system is really smart. And I don't want to get into a whole thing. I'll save that for another week. But basically, it's challenging and strategic, and you have to really think about everything, and you can't just smash X. You have to think about like which abilities you're going to use when and plan things out. And it's really smart. It's really got this whole set of systems that work really well together. And I like, if you play it, I recommend playing on the higher difficulty. I'm playing on heroine difficulty, which I think is the equivalent of hard, the second hardest difficulty. And yeah, I'm really enjoying it. It's really interesting and challenging in a good way. Nice. All right, let's get to the news.
Let's do it.
So, first of all,
Call it the News Hour. Wait a minute. You didn't call it the News Hour. I was waiting
the
for
News Hour.
News of the Week. News of the Week actually works. That
news
is
of the
accurate.
Week. Isn't that the name of a publication? Like
probably.
A News Corp
it's
thing?
Probably
or
the
something?
Name of like six publications and podcasts.
Yeah.
Well, the News Hour, anyway.
Podcasts are the new thing. So, those publications will be dead, and Kotaku Split Screen will still be carrying on with News of the Week. All right, news item number one. PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds, which is a game I know nothing about, sells 1 million copies. And just to be clear, the name of the game is PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds. But I think that Kotaku should just call it Battlegrounds because it's the equivalent of calling it Sid Meier's Civilization.
I thought that we had established that PlayerUnknown is the alias of the creator.
Yes.
Thus, calling it PlayerUnknown's Battleground is akin to calling Sid Meier's Civilization Sid Meier's Civilization.
And I think that
which
eventually
we do not
we'll
do.
Get to. The problem is that Battlegrounds is such a bad name and Civilization is such a good name that people in the press and stuff have just been calling it PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds, which is like... Like, I don't know, when I see a headline on IGN or whatever, they're calling it PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds. So, I don't know. I guess we'll see if that changes over time. But I've been trying to get Kotaku to just call it Battlegrounds. Anyway, it sold 1 million copies. It's kind of this year's Stardew Valley in that it came out of nowhere and is a huge indie hit. And, yeah, I don't know anything about it. I just thought that was interesting news.
I will... Just so that people know something about it, if you haven't been following this, Nathan Grayson, who runs Steamed, our PC gaming subsite, has written about this game quite a bit. I just looked up his article. His initial article about it is, Steam's latest hit is a more tactical, less chaotic battle royale game.
Yeah, that's what it is.
So what I get the sense, and it's sort of got that like H1Z1 or DayZ, like where you're all dropped into a like area together, and you have to just whoever lives longest wins. It's that kind of a game, and I haven't played it. These games stress me out, where you're having to talk to other people and they're like on their microphone trying to fuck with you, and like like all of that is too much. But it seems like really popular and people are really into it, which generally means that it's pretty good. You know, games like this don't get popular for no reason. It's cool that it sold 1 million copies. I definitely want to check it out. Maybe at some point we'll play it and have Nathan on to talk about the game.
Okay, next news item. Star Wars Battlefront 2 trailer came out. Did you watch that?
I didn't. I just looked at the
images.
Okay,
so it leaked out. It looks cool. It looks like everything that Star Wars Battlefront 1 fans wanted, which is a single-player campaign, appearances from all the new characters like Rey and Finn and all that. And yeah, it basically seems
So do you think a single player campaign is, I mean, I don't know, like you've played like a battle, like I guess Battlefield, the most recent Battlefield game had an okay single player campaign, but don't you think there's a pretty good chance that this is just going to be some stapled on bullshit?
No.
No, you think a single player campaign is going to be good?
Yeah, I think it could be good. I think it, because it's not just DICE, it's they also have the folks at EA Motive, which is their new studio working on it.
Oh, they're working on this.
Yeah, and they have a whole team. They have like a bunch of people dedicated to it, and they're making a big thing out of it. And yeah, I do think it could be good. This would make me more interested than I was in the first game. I wasn't interested in playing a multiplayer Battlefront.
Well, and actually playing a lot of Battlefield 1 made me... which I really got into and was really fun. And that was the first Battlefield game I think I've really ever gotten into. I have Battlefield 1942. Oh yeah, we talked about this on the show and you made a joke about it, I remember. Because I said I haven't gotten into a Battlefield game since 1942. And you were like, wow, that's a long time ago to be playing Battlefield.
I'm
sure that listeners are enjoying hearing me shittily recap that joke. Battlefield 1 did make me think, oh, I would love to play a Star Wars version of this. And I know people are dying for a Star Wars single player game. So
yeah,
I feel
it's
like
been
it's
so
even
long.
if it's even decent, that'll be cool.
When was the last time we had a Star Wars single player game? I mean, 2010 or something like that.
Jesus.
Does Kinect Star Wars count? Force Unleashed 2?
Does it? I guess Force Unleashed 2. I would say that is what we're talking about.
So yeah, it's about time. And then finally, final news item, Xbox Scorpio specs revealed. And this is actually last week, but it was after after we recorded last week's episode. Right, I think it was last Thursday that it was officially revealed. And so Eurogamer had a whole big thing. They had like five articles where they Microsoft paid for them to fly out and visit the thing and do a Digital Foundry like dig into the specs of Scorpio, and people are really excited. It's a really powerful machine. It's got lots of teraflops, you know, teraflops.
Yeah, I think this is we've talked about this before, and this the number of teraflops doesn't really change the fundamental thing that we've discussed, I think, ad nauseum on the show, which is just that Microsoft needs a game strategy to make this thing work. I'll continually be suspicious of, like, I need to know more about what games it can run just on a technical level. I think they talked about a Forza demo that was running in 4K at 60 frames per second, which is great. But I think I saw this, and this is off the top of my head, but I believe I saw someone basically equating the graphics processing power to a GTX 1070. I think they said 1060, 1070, which is a slight cut under the 1080, which is actually no longer even the king of the hill now. The 1080 Ti and the new Titan are that. And I feel like the 1080 Ti, and not to get totally sidetracked on this, but that is the most recent NVIDIA graphics card. That thing, from Mike Fahey using it, it sounds to me like that is the first card that's really able to like run games solidly at 60 frames per second in 4K.
How much
resolution.
Does that cost?
I think it's like $600.
So this thing itself, I mean, we still don't know how much the Scorpio will be, but this could be $500, and that's for the entire machine.
No, right. Right. So let me finish. So I'm not actually, that's not the comparison that I'm drawing. It's more that GPU, significantly more powerful than what the Scorpio is doing, I believe. And that is just now able to run 4K games at 60 frames per second. I'm skeptical. I remain skeptical of that console, even this really powerful, I'm skeptical that it will actually mean, oh, all games are going to be high resolution. We're going to get way more games running at 60 frames per second on Scorpio. It'd be cool if that were the case, but I'll believe it when I see it.
So that poses an interesting question, right? So I think most people, even the most hardcore Xbox fans, have given up on the idea that Microsoft will have exclusives that compete with the PS4s, right? So you're not going to get games like Uncharted and Horizon on the Xbox Scorpio, unless Microsoft suddenly switches strategies and stops closing studios and canceling games, which is possible. But let's say that's unrealistic at this point. So here's the question, right? If Scorpio comes out this fall and suddenly a game like Destiny 2 or Red Dead 2 or anything else, third-party stuff that comes out over the next few years, is running at 60 frames a second on Scorpio and only 30 per seconds on the PS4 and PS4 Pro, is that going to change like the way we play? Will people start moving to the Scorpio?
It could. And I think, the biggest difference between, I think, between this and the last generation, I thought about the PS3 versus the 360, was the PS3 was the more powerful console, but it was harder to develop for. And I think Microsoft is, you know, really trying to drive home this thing is just a PC. It's really easy to develop for.
Yeah.
And if there's going to be a PC version of, let's say, Red Dead Redemption 2, let's just pretend that Rockstar is going to release a PC version along with the console versions, which probably won't happen because Rockstar doesn't do that, but say they are. And then, I don't know, if they have the bandwidth, there would be no reason to not make a Scorpio version that runs better. It's just, will that actually happen? It's an open question. If it did happen, I do think, I think there are plenty of people who would say, well, I'd rather play it on Scorpio. Even then, though, I don't know, man. What do you think?
I have lots of thoughts, so interesting. It'll be really interesting to see. It'll be interesting to see how Sony feels about that. And if Sony says, like, oh, you can't do this, we'll pay you not to do this. And if it starts turning into that sort of...
Or if you own a PS4, which so many people own PS4s, if they've outsold the Xbox One by so much, do you buy an Xbox or a Scorpio, whatever it winds up being called, just for that?
Especially
because you can also get a gaming PC. And
yeah.
like you can... build a gaming PC for not that much more. Right. That's equally powerful.
It's a weird place. It doesn't, it feels like it's a weird fit in today's gaming. Like right now, the ideal way to play video games kind of objectively, unless you're really into Halo and Gears of War and Halo Wars.
Get ready for some tweets. You're about to say something is objectively the best way to play games. You can get
I've already gotten so many tweets about the Scorpio stuff. Did you, cause
I'm immune to tweets.
Well, the Xbox fans are just insane. They're like, there's so many people with Scorpios in their handles. I think they're all really young, that's the thing, but there are also a couple of people on Twitter who I won't name who are like the rabble rousers, and they're the ones who just encourage these legions of Xbox fans to harass people, and they also get like associated with Microsoft. Like Phil Spencer will be tweeting at them constantly and just like interacting with them and treating them like they're passionate fans who he associates with and interacts with. So really Microsoft is enabling a lot of this stuff, which is pretty fucked up. But anyway, we're getting sidetracked. So I think the ideal way to play video games right now, unless you're really into Microsoft's exclusives, or I guess if you're into the OS or whatever, is to have a gaming PC and then like a PS4 for the Horizons and Uncharted and Neos and Personas and all the other stuff that Sony has secured on there, and then a Switch because that Zelda is unmissable. Because
then you can play the best game of the last however many years.
Yeah.
Well, and like you said, exclusives, but even if you're into Microsoft's exclusives, you can play Gears of War and Forza Horizon. Dude, I've been playing Forza Horizon 3
on PC
because I upgraded my PC and it can run it really well now. And that game is awesome.
Yeah.
That's a really good exclusive that would, you know, like it's the most fun racing game I played in forever, but I can just play it on my PC. I'm not going
to
play it on Xbox.
So wait, so we have to take PC owners, gaming PC players out of the equation here because for them, the Scorpio is not really relevant. So let's say that I play on PS4 primarily or PS4 and Switch, some combination of that. The big question is, how does Scorpio fit into my life? Is it going to be worth it for me to get a Scorpio if it plays, if Red Dead 2 comes out and that runs at 60 frames per second on the Scorpio? The answer could be yes. I mean, maybe it is worth it because that might change the way the game plays. If we're just talking about a resolution difference, or we're just talking about like 1080p versus 900p or some other like graphical changes that don't make as big a difference, then the answer is probably no, and there's probably no reason to have
one. And there's, man, it really is a whole long conversation that will get easier to have, and I'm sure we'll have over the course of the year, because
there's
the question
more
of, do you have a 4K TV? Like, are 4K TVs standardized? Do people want to buy them yet? Which I think is an open question.
I think lot of people do.
I mean, but they're still a pain in the ass to buy. Like, if you start looking at 4K TVs, like, there's still these competing standards, and it's still not a sure bet that your $800, whatever, $600 TV is going to be the right one to get. It's getting clearer and clearer, but it feels to me like we're not quite there. And then there's the question of, like, a game like Destiny 2 or Red Dead Redemption, which will have a significant online component. Can you merge the Xbox One player base with the Scorpio player base? If half of your player base is playing the game at 60 frames per second and half of the player base is playing at 30 frames per second,
you can't.
Not only is that like arguably an advantage in multiplayer for people at 60 frames, but also like there could be netcode issues and just syncing frames across
different
games.
No, you would have to lock it.
Like,
you would have to lock
it. Yeah, you'd have to lock it. Or maybe, I mean, maybe not. Maybe there's some solution we don't know about. But regardless, there are all these questions that have not yet been answered. And I don't know if they'll have easy answers. And it's just, there's a lot here to figure out how it's going to work, and it's going to be complicated and probably messy and inconsistent when it
happens. It'll be interesting. It will be interesting. See a path for Microsoft in releasing a Scorpio and securing third-party games that run better on Scorpio. And I mean, I can see them winning over a lot of hardcore.
Yeah, and then in two or three years, there's like it's just become established. There's way games just play better and look better on the system. Yeah.
Well, in two or three years, Sony might have their own newer version of the PS4 Pro.
Right. I guess we're speeding up the rate at which we get these things. So the PS4 Super Pro comes out. And Jesus.
Well, we'll see. And we'll see more at E3, I imagine, unless Microsoft has other PR exclusive deals or something about Gamma Sutra, from Gamma Sutra that was like the dev kit. So maybe they have something else coming too. Or they're like, here, we'll pay.
I bet at E3 they name it, right? Like they say what it's actually called.
You don't think it's going to be called Scorpio?
No, I thought that was still the code name. Maybe. I hope it's still the code name. It's a terrible name.
It is a terrible name. But so many people have those stupid symbols in their names now that it's become a whole brand for them. So it would be kind of stupid for them to get rid of that at this point.
We'll see, I guess.
Yeah, we will see.
We'll see.
Yeah, the thing that Twitter users were getting on my case about was because I pointed out that Microsoft paid for Eurogamer's trip, which seemed like a strange thing, because it's like Eurogamer got this huge exclusive and flew out and ran 5 articles and was probably getting a lot of traffic. I mean, their site crashed, but they couldn't afford they couldn't pay for their own flight and hotel. But I didn't even think it was a big deal. And of course, I got all these nasty messages from Xbox fans because the typical rabble rousers started capping my tweets. And you know how it goes. You know how it goes.
Yes, I do. I do know how it goes.
All right. So now we are going to have Ashley Birch on the show. I'm very excited to talk to her about Horizon and all that.
Very exciting guest.
Cool, let's do it.
Yeah, let's get to it.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Ashley Birch is a well-known writer and actor. You have heard her voice in many video games. She was Chloe in Life is Strange. She played Tiny Tina in Borderlands 2, and most recently voiced Aloy, the protagonist of the very good PS4 game Horizon Zero Dawn. We're very excited to talk to her today about a bunch of things. Hi, Ashley. How's it going?
Hey, how you guys doing?
You know, pretty good. We're
hanging in there.
We're hanging in there. I feel like we should ask you about the weather. How's the weather where you are right now?
It's actually really nice. I don't know where you guys are, but I'm in LA and it's sunny and there's like a breeze going. It's actually pretty ideal, man. which is a horrible thing to say depending on where you are right now.
So your most recent accomplishment or your most recent game is Horizon Zero Dawn, which Jason and I have both talked about on the show and like very much. How are you feeling now that this game is out that you're the main character in?
Relieved. Definitely relieved. Yeah. yeah, I mean, it's. I've been working, before the game came out, I was working on it for about 2 years. And, and just sort of working on it in a vacuum and feeling a lot of excitement, but also a lot of responsibility because this was a game with a sole protagonist. So you didn't get to choose which gender you were playing. You had to play as Aloy, and that's a pretty uncommon thing, in particular for really big budget open world games. And so I felt a lot of responsibility, and excitement, but also nervousness to make her a really compelling character. And I wasn't sure how people were going to respond to her, and I wasn't even sure how people were going to respond to the game because it was a completely new IP. So it was super exciting, but also a little bit nerve-wracking not knowing how people would feel about it.
I'm really curious about the process. I've talked to, you know, voice actors in the past, and the sense I've always gotten is, you know, these games like this come together over a long period of time, and they tend to kind of come together toward the end. And I would imagine, like, what's the process like of trying to make a character where I would imagine there are times where you're just reading lines and you have no real idea what, you know, where this fits in? Or like, does that ever happen where you just don't even really know what you're reading and you're trying to figure out how to make it work?
Yeah, the beginning of the process actually was pretty, there was a lot of that. There was a lot of me trying to sort of parse what my relationship was to different characters just through contextual clues. And I usually, in other games, I can usually do that. Like, I can usually, like, I know enough about games and I've played enough games that if I go into a context where I'm a more minor character, potentially, I can sort of suss out, okay, I'm probably talking to the player character, X, Y, or Z thing is happening, you know, whatever. And also I have a director there to help me. But actually at the beginning of Horizon, I didn't have a dedicated director. I had the devs on the line with me, but I didn't have someone to kind of work back and forth with as far as finding Aloy's voice and figuring out what the landscape was in the context of whatever particular mission we were in. And so I actually, we talked to the dev team and we got a really awesome director. Originally it was a woman named Amanda Wyatt, And then she got super busy. And so we brought on Jamie Modulero, who is a really awesome director. He's worked on the Hitman games. I think he's basically directed every Hitman game that's come out.
Those games have great, great voice acting, actually.
Yeah. And so he and I really worked together to figure out Aloy. And also we helped, he helped me suss out along with the devs where I was emotionally in any particular scene in comparison to like the larger narrative arc, and what my relationships to the different tribes were and the different characters and who they were. And together we kind of puzzled out like what Aloy would think or feel about any particular group or character. But there was actually a point we hit where we reviewed some of the much earlier stuff that we had done in the game. And I remember thinking like, this isn't Aloy anymore. And so I asked if we could actually go back and revisit some of those earlier scenes.
Well, so can we back up a second? So,
sure.
Ashley, can you tell us like how you got this role and how it was presented to you in the first place? Why don't you start from there? I mean, so we knew for a while that Guerrilla Games, they finished Killzone, Shadowfall, and then they're moving on to a new IP. Did they approach you? Did you have to audition? What happened there?
I auditioned a few times. So I think they were casting for Aloy pretty early on in the process. So I got sides with a bit of a description about her and I think a little bit about the world.
Okay.
And I could see that there was
and
a scene.
And this is the same description? Like, what was the description then? Was it the same as the modern description of Aloy, or how does it change a lot?
I don't remember because it was like 3 years ago now, but I think it was something along the lines of like this, you know, I think it might have said that she was a player character, but I don't know if it actually did. Mostly it was just like, this is a strong, you know, she's a young woman, raised as an outcast, strong, maybe a little suspicious of people, etc. And the sides were actually dialogue tree options. So when I saw that, I was like, oh, okay. I think I remember seeing this is the same scene with different emotional responses. So I was like, okay, it's a dialogue tree game. It's a game with dialogue trees in it.
Right. So to kind of suss it out.
Right. And so I was like, okay, then she's probably the player character if that's the case. And so I auditioned for her once. And then I think, I'm not sure actually, I should ask them at some point what happened with their development cycle. But I didn't hear anything for a really long time. So I was like, okay, I didn't get it. And then the sides, updated sides came around again. And I was like, oh, I think I've auditioned for this character before. So I did it again. And then I got a call back. And that was actually, it was like a callback for the original E3 trailer that came out. So it wasn't 100% that I was going to play the role, but I was like, I think it was between me and one other woman. And so they ended up using my voice for the E3 trailer. And then even still, it was kind of like, okay, she's in the E3 trailer, but we need to make sure that she doesn't do insane stuff with her face when we decide to do facial capture.
So wait, did they tell you that you were going to be in the E3 trailer, or did you just find out?
Yes, they did.
Okay.
They did, yeah. So they
showed me.
Because
it'd be funny if you only found out while at E3 that like you're
right. No, yeah, they showed me actually some of the, I don't think it was actually even early rendering. I think they showed me some of the gameplay stuff, and it was the first time that I sort of realized like, oh God, this is a really huge game. And it's really beautiful. And there are robot dinosaurs. Like, everything about it, I was just sort of, like, taken aback.
Dinosaurs. Okay.
I was like, whoa. I was just really, because, again, like, every time you audition for something, at least for me, I send it out into the ether and I assume I will never hear about it again. So when I got called back in, I had no idea that Horizon was going to be such a big deal until I saw that gameplay footage. And I was like, oh, holy shit, this is a really big game.
Gotcha.
So a term that you used was sides, which I think maybe some of our listeners might not know that
term.
Oh,
sure.
What is a side? Like, I'm gathering that that's just like an excerpt of dialogue or something, but is that accurate?
Yeah, so audition sides are what your agency sends you to, so you can read for the role. So sides kind of vary, but lots of video game sides will have concept art of the character, a brief description about their personality, maybe a brief description about their past, and any other pertinent relationships they have with other characters. And they'll give you like age range, race. If they have any particular ideas for like vocal quality, they might give you a reference. Like, we want her to kind of sound like Emma Stone or Kristen Stewart.
Is that common? Is Emma Stone a common one?
Emma Stone actually, I think, is a common one. I see Emma Stone a lot. And who else do I see a lot? Oh, Scarlett Johansson I see a lot.
Oh, yeah. Shocker.
Okay.
And then you'll get scenes of dialogue that are somewhat short, but they're usually a couple, and the intention is to show that you have range and you can understand mm-hmm. how this character would operate in different emotional spaces. Mm-hmm. And you send those in and assume that you'll never get it. Like I said, you just pop them out into the ether.
It's funny because they have to kind of not tell you too much. Like we've gotten, like I know that we've even gotten leaks of games because the voiceover script like told enough about the game that people could figure out what it was. So I'd imagine it's this weird dance where you have to determine a lot based on not that much information because they don't want to just tell you, here's everything about the game and here are the specs and it's going to have robot dinosaurs. It's more just you see that afterwards, which I would imagine makes the process kind of interesting.
Yeah, again, it was one of those things where I got these sides for Aloy, and I think they mentioned that, you know, she had she was part of a tribe or outcast from a tribe, and so I had mm-hmm. some sense that tribes were involved, but the logical leap is not then robot dinosaurs. So,
right. It's
so that took me by surprise.
Well, it is a video game, so I feel like the logical leap would be robot dinosaurs.
You can always kind of guess, right?
That's fair.
So you were saying, so E3 2014, so when did you find out, like, for sure you are Aloy? I assume it was them, right? But you didn't know you were the main character then, you were saying?
Well, so that E3 trailer came out, and I think they were kind of... this is me guessing, actually. I actually don't know. But I think they were still kind of figuring out their process and deciding mm-hmm. How much... Because, of course, there are different levels of performance that an actor can give in a video game. There's just voice. Sure. Mm-hmm. There's voice and facial capture. There's voice, facial capture, and motion capture. Mm-hmm. So I think they were sort of figuring out to what degree they wanted me, you know, involved in all of those aspects. And so I came in after the E3 trailer for a movement and facial capture audition. Okay.
Oh, that's cool.
Which is more like an on-camera audition where you go in, mm-hmm. you memorize, and you perform. And after that, then it was like, okay, you don't make crazy faces when you're voice acting, so you're good.
So did you do that? You did facial capture and voice acting for the character?
I did, yeah. I almost did motion capture, but I would have had to go to London for like weeks at a time.
Oh, okay. Mm.
And I was working on Adventure Time as well at the time. So,
Everything in LA? You didn't have to go to Amsterdam?
I did everything in LA.
Because mm-hmm. the developers are based in Amsterdam in the Netherlands. So,
yeah, they are.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
So at that point, like, obviously you're doing things non-linearly, but at any point, do you sit down with the writers, with John Gonzalez and the writing team there, and they tell you the full story, or do you just find out in bits and pieces over the course of development?
I assume
they were still working on the story up until very late as well, because it's video games.
Right, and I think they knew where they were going, so I think they knew where they wanted to end up at the end of the game. But I mostly got briefed on any particular scene day of.
Okay.
And sort of a lot of the discovery. It's interesting acting that way. And that was also my experience a bit on Life is Strange, is that I would come in and mm-hmm. I'd sort of be discovering the events of the story kind of alongside Chloe or alongside Aloy,
right.
Which was interesting. But yeah, there are certain things. But then, of course, we had like periods of time where I was there were a few months, especially later in development, where I was recording every single day. Mm-hmm. So I would kind of know where we were headed. Like, I guess, should I try to avoid spoilers probably?
Yeah, we'll stay vague in the spoilers, but people can know. It's not too spoiler to say that Aloy gradually uncovers this history.
A mystery.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So later on in that story, you know, in the back half of the game when you and Silence mm-hmm. are like really figuring out what's going on.
Yeah.
Kirk is just
getting up to that part.
Oh, yeah. Really?
It's been very entertaining.
So we can't spoil it for him. We won't spoil it for him. Kirk is in the thick of it.
Okay, cool. So yeah, I kind of had the long view for all of that sort of stuff. I knew where we were headed.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. But yeah, as far as like, and also it's interesting because, you know, there's so many individual missions in that game that don't necessarily mm-hmm. pertain to anything outside of
right. yeah,
that
yeah.
one storyline. So
tons and tons of voice acting. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and it also, like, a lot of the story I'm noticing, and I've been since I've been playing it a lot over the last few nights in particular, and I'm thinking about your performance just because we're about to talk on the show, and I'm like, okay, this is what it would be like to record this. You know, one interesting thing about this game is that a lot of the story is told through these audio diaries, which is this conflicting thing for me because, like, audio diaries are annoying, but also the backstory is really good, and it's like listening to this really cool, like, apocalyptic radio play. And actually, sure. Aloy only sort of, she kind of responds to a lot of it. Like, she'll be like, wow, that's really sad, after you listen to this, you know, 5-minute saga. Uh-huh. But she doesn't actually have to do anything, so they could write that stuff in the spaces in between your performance,
right,
and kind of fill the game out, which I thought was cool. I'm curious, have you played the finished game? Like, have you played it all the way through?
I have not played it all the way through. I have.
Yeah, I know that's a thing.
I kind of started it, actually. Well, I started it with a friend, but then I decided that I kind of just wanted to play it on my own to sort of unwind, because it actually is a really good game.
Yeah, which it is. This is very fun.
It's super fun.
And is so it weird for you playing it and listening to it?
Yeah, I really want to know what it's like.
It's super weird. I mean, when I just saw, like, clips online, or even just watching my friend play it a little bit, it wasn't as weird, but, like, spending that much time, because I've never been a player character before. So, like, controlling, and every time I pick up a medicinal herb, or, like, I get spotted by a watcher, and I'm like, ugh. And it's interesting, too, because I have a different relationship with some of the other characters or whatever as a player than Aloy does. Mm-hmm. So it's also a strange thing where I remember recording those scenes, and I remember how I felt as Aloy. But now as Ashley, I have a completely different perspective.
Right,
it's really strange.
So one thing I've noticed, especially is in this game, there's a lot of just sort of grunting and breathing and jumping and getting hit. Does that just, that would freak me out. There are parts where I'm like kind of doing the open world game thing where you mantle up like a shitty cliff to try to get to the top, like in a way you're not meant to go. And Aloy's just like, like jumping. And I'm like, man, if I were you playing this game, like hearing yourself back doing that would be extremely odd, I would think.
It's interesting. That stuff is less weird. I don't know why.
Okay.
I think maybe because it's so... That stuff, well, less so now, because I know the toll it can take on your vocal cords. But when I first started doing voiceover, that was always so fun to me because it's so video gamey. And, like, I grew up playing video games, and I've heard all the pain grunts and, like, the jump noises and whatever. So the first time I had to do, like, a small jump... And often directors will kind of model it for you, just so you don't, like, you know, burn out your vocal cords, like, trying to find the noise. But I can't remember what game it was, but my director was like, it's kind of like a... And I was like, oh, I know.
I've been
preparing my whole life for this moment.
That's awesome.
Did you get to work with Lance Reddick and the other actors that are in the game, or are you just in a booth by yourself?
I was in a booth by myself. I
really wanted to ask about that because I actually just got to where Lance Reddick turns up, and you're basically doing scenes with Lance Reddick, which
I
is
know.
Super cool.
All this searching, and I'm still no closer.
If that's your reaction to everything you've just learned, to whine like a spoiled child,
you should really try talking that way to me face to face.
As you wish. Do you really have no idea how monumental are the discoveries you just made, Aloy? I expected more of you.
So, you have a face. Got a name to go with it?
Of all the questions you could ask right now, that's the one you choose.
Have you met him?
No, I haven't. And I remember
the
day that I was like, because hopefully it's not too much of a spoiler for Kirk, but you talk to Silence a lot in the game.
Yeah, and, that's not that bad.
Okay, cool.
I assumed that would happen.
Okay, cool. Yeah. I don't think they would give Lance Reddick a fly-by-night character. But but yeah, I remember I'd like done a couple of scenes with Silence, and I just got curious. I was like, I wonder who's playing this character that I'm spending so much time with.
That's so
And so
funny.
I asked them, and they were like, oh, it's Lance Reddick. And I was like, what? It's Lieutenant Daniels! And I like... I kind of lost it.
That's super good. Just even listening to it. And, you know, like I said, I've been playing it sort of thinking about your performance and just being like, well, this must be really cool for Ashley to hear herself.
Yeah, it was
basically
so
also
cool.
Dressing down Lance Reddick and being like, no, you jerk, you're wrong. Listen to me. I know what's going on. And it's very
I know he's been like shitty to me and I'm like giving him quips back. It's so surreal.
So I want to hear more about what the actual process of recording this thing was like. So it's, you said it was 2 years, right? Was that, I mean, you were doing other stuff, but how many hours a week over 2 years is that about?
So it started slower where I was only doing like a session or two, like a week or every 2 weeks or something like that. And then deeper into development, there were like months, there were a few months where I was like recording every single day, sometimes for the entire day.
Wow.
And yeah, it was kind of like me and Jamie, my director, and then either one of the writers or Jonah, who's the director of the cutscenes, or Jochen, who is kind of the talent coordinator, you know, one of the devs on the line with us. And we would kind of just roll through scenes and figure it out. And then there were certain days where it was just sort of conversational dialogue. Or like, you know, you go and you speak to any character and you get like different options to different speech options or whatever. And then on the days where we'd had cut scenes, they would put dots on my face and we would mostly just do cuts. We would do like a chunk of cut scenes that day. And I would see their recorded motion capture and then sort of mimic the movements and react and then say the lines, you know, while still keeping true to whatever movements had already been captured. So we would,
is there room for improvisation there, or do you have to follow the script pretty strictly?
There's room for it. I think I tended to, the most that I would do often is just to like make the lines sound more true to Aloy for me, and they were totally open to that.
There's a specific line I'm wondering about, just that I wanted to ask about that I saw last night, is Aloy goes through some water and she comes out and I have subtitles on and it says, that was ... refreshing. And I was expecting her to be like, that was refreshing. Like it wasn't refreshing, but the line was actually, that was refreshing. Like it was actually refreshing.
Right.
I don't know if you remember that line, but that is that like, I wanted to ask about it just because I saw it and thought, you know,
Kirk only
there's two different ways you could have read this that would like imply a different character for Aloy though, right? Like one is kind of more sarcastic and one is more genuine, and she's actually a pretty genuine person.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's the sort of thing you're talking about, but that was something that I noticed.
Yeah, it's interesting because she, I think that was something that they definitely liked about my initial auditions, is that I found moments to give her snark or to be able to like, here we go, kind of like element, you know, sort of like, fuck. but also the I think the other important thing about Aloy is that she is very uncynical. And that's something that silence is a counterpoint to her in that way, where she is really always kind of searching for the lighter side of any situation. And she's smart, so she knows that people can be terrible, but she's compassionate enough and open enough that she tends to give people the benefit of the doubt. There's an Aloy cosplayer who took this really lovely photo of her, of Aloy seeing snow. And it looks like she's seeing snow for the first time, because she's just got her hands out and she's like looking up in awe at the sky as like snowflakes come down. And to me, that's such a sweet, and that's a huge part of her, I think, is that she has a genuine curiosity. And I think I think it's interesting because honestly, I think what you assumed the read could be could totally be Aloy, but I think there's also completely something about like, oh, that actually was nice. Like that being like something that she actually enjoys.
I've been running around like for the last 6 hours and it was sort of nice doing that. There's a great line. There's a great exchange between you and Lance Reddick. I don't know if you've gotten to this scene where he says, yeah, actually the world is round. You probably didn't know this, but it's flat. And she's like, no, dude, obviously I know the world is round because the moon like has this shadow on it. And she just totally owns him. And it's really good because she just is like smart enough to figure out that the world is round
from
observing the world, which is, it was a good line. The writing in the game is good. I don't know. I like it. It is really good.
It's especially for the amount that they had to put in this game, like the number of side quests and the number of just scenes in general. There is a little too much audio. I was thinking before about, have you guys played South Park, The Stick of Truth?
Yeah.
So there's a funny section in that game where you're going through a spaceship and you pick up all these audio logs, and it's just a guy talking about audio logs, and he's like, all that's here is audio logs. I'm so hungry, but I just keep finding audio logs.
The only thing I can do is make it. Why am I even recording this? And he can't stop. And he like dies.
He just can't stop recording audio logs.
Yeah, that's good.
But yeah, but no, you did a fantastic job. So what is the most difficult thing about playing the main character in this giant open world RPG like this? Is it just the sheer amount of stuff, or are there other really tough things, obstacles in your way as you are recording Aloy, becoming Aloy?
So one of the things is finding an emotional place that she can live in that feels true and honest, but also is something that can be applied over several different contexts. Because it is an open world game,
right?
You can play missions at any particular point. So you could mm-hmm. go all the way to the very end of the game where Aloy has learned all of this stuff and seemingly changed so much. And then you could go all the way back to the mission at the beginning. And
yeah,
play
right,
it.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, do the hunting lodge or something. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Go that side mission that you didn't do.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. So finding a place that she can live and that feels genuine for any circumstance that she's in, while also making her a fully fleshed out
right.
character.
And not just a monotone robot.
Right. That has like a rich emotional landscape and like a perspective. Because Aloy definitely had, like, there are other, you know, open world games where you pretty much shape your protagonist entirely. I don't think mm-hmm. Aloy is one of those games. Like, Aloy comes. Mm-hmm. Basically already, you know, she's an established character and you can sort of influence how compassionate versus intellectual versus like aggressive she is. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. those are all sort of shades that exist within her anyway, I think as a character. So
that's one of the things that makes Horizon great, is that it doesn't feel like you're playing this Cypher. I mean, which can playing a Cypher can have its advantages, but mm-hmm. with Horizon, it's like Aloy, you're like, holy shit, yeah. I love this character that I'm playing.
It's definitely more The Witcher 3 than Mass Effect.
Yes, say. Exactly. Right, it helps right, that she yeah. has the most badass hair in any video game.
Dude,
I've ever played.
That's true.
That hair animation. Hair. Oh my God.
Yeah.
It's really incredible. It's really, I mean, some of the things they did with graphics in that game, just in general, like the technical achievements are just remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
It's insane. I went to, so for the launch party, I actually went to Amsterdam and I got to finally go to Gorilla and meet all of these people
that was your first time. The launch party was your first
time. Mm-hmm.
Holy shit.
I had never met anyone in person. So I met, I know. So I'd met all the writers and, the creative leads, and I went through and they gave me a tour of the studio and I was meeting all the animators and all of the designers. And I sat with, someone that had done, the costume, like Aloy's original costume that she gets from Teb, mm-hmm. like the Nora Brave outfit. Mm-hmm. And there were pieces of that outfit that he just sort of painstakingly fit one piece at a time, like layers, like yeah. little itty bitty, like fucking polygons that he was just like putting in like with digital tweezers. And he was like, yeah, this was like a few, this was like, you know, me crunching for hours before the E3,
oh
you know,
man.
Launch trailer, just whatever. And I was just, good. The video level games. Of detail is insane mm-hmm. in that game, to the point where, like, depending on what tribe it is, each tribe is like assigned a different type of wood. Like this tribe would use, you know, birch tree, or this
right,
this
right,
you know this
stuff.
Would use oak, or you know what I mean? Like,
wow.
And they had like a reasoning and like a logic for everything. It was just mm-hmm. Going through. I was already blown away by the game, but like to know that level of detail was every aspect of the game had that level of detail and like precision. It was insane.
Yeah, man. It's a hell of a game.
Yeah.
Man, video games.
Man, video games.
And just the fact that people have to spend all these hours and just crunch so much putting in like the tiniest little details. And yeah. I hope a lot of people appreciate that sort of thing.
The leg shifts. I did a post that was just a gif of
yeah,
of
the
Aloy
way that her legs
rotating in her saddle. And she pulls her leg up over the saddle, and then it's slowly, it's just like, holy shit, like somebody that just, the fact that someone just painstakingly hand animated that whole thing frame by frame is ridiculous.
Yeah, I can't believe, so you never got a chance to like go out there. They didn't need you out there for any reason, even doing the, so you did all the motion capturing, everything in LA.
Yeah, actually, I wasn't
the
able to do
capturing,
the motion
sorry.
Capture.
No, the facial capturing is what I meant.
Yeah, the facial capture I did in LA. Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, that seems crazy to me, because I would think that like an actor just needs to be sitting with the writers, and I guess you're so far removed from the technical people and the other parts of the team that it's just not necessary, huh?
Well, that's part of, you know, being a voice actor. You have to sort of construct your reality out of you know, pieces. Because
yeah,
like an on-camera actor can have set costume other people to act off of or whatever.
Uh-huh.
But you're just, if you're just in a booth and you have to voice this character and you have to give life to this situation that you have no visual context for, it's something that you kind of learn to work around. And yeah, and so again, like the writers were, you know, on Skype with me session, kind of helping guide me through.
So one of the things you mentioned before is that you went back and changed some of the earlier stuff later mm-hmm. in the game. What kind of stuff did you change? Is this just, like what kind of stuff did you find that had you recorded that didn't feel like Aloy to you anymore?
I think in some of the earlier scenes, she seemed a bit too young and a bit, maybe okay. a bit too petulant. A bit more easy to get to, I think. Like, she didn't have as much resilience as we sort of found, like, oh, no, this is who she... Like, so it was a sort of finding it and, like, thinking about it in terms of, like, okay, these are the emotional places that someone could go to based on what's happened to her. But who is she actually? And how would she take these situations and turn the, you know, create the alchemy of emotion to make her the person that who she becomes? The place that we found her... kind of as a group and collaborating, like, okay, this is Aloy. And so when we did find her, yeah. So going back to some of that earlier stuff, it's like she, because I really wanted to make sure that she was not just like a capital S strong female character with no humor or a vulnerability of any kind, because I just think that's boring. So I wanted her to feel rich and vulnerable in different moments, but it was about choosing those moments and finding a baseline for her that, you know, was more resilient and had more strength in it, but allowing for places of, you know, awe or curiosity or suspicion or annoyance or whatever. And so, yeah, when we kind of landed on that over the course of a couple of sessions, when we reviewed later, I was like, that's not Aloy anymore, guys. we gotta figure it out. Cause it's just going to be like, bleh. Yeah, it's going to be
and
like,
and you realize they gave you the time and the band and the resources to like go and do all that stuff.
Well, Jamie was awesome because he always made sure, cause he heard it too. And he was like, yeah. And I could see him being like, yeah, I totally hear what you're saying. But he also has to be aware of like time and how much stuff we had to get through. So it was always a conversation. And the great thing about Gorilla and all the devs is that, like, again, they really saw it as a collaboration. And I think when they heard that earlier stuff too, I think they could hear like, oh yeah, this really isn't Aloy anymore. We've moved past this and she's sort of evolved. And so they were always open to, and they trusted us a lot. So if I was like, I feel like I can get that and make it better. And then we also had to be discerning. Like, I couldn't just do it if I was like, oh, I kind of wish that performance had a little bit more, you know, we had to pick our battles a little bit in terms of like, I couldn't just go back if I was like, that wasn't the groundbreaking performance of video games. It had to be like, no, that just isn't the character anymore. So,
yeah.
Yeah. It's funny. We were talking to Ron Gilbert a couple of weeks ago, the creator of Monkey Island, who just released his game Thimbleweed Park. And he was telling it, we were talking about voice acting because he had some problems with voice actors. And we had watched a Double Fine documentary and they had problems where they had delay production for a couple of weeks because one of their voice actors had a family emergency. And he was saying how it's really interesting because voice actors tend to be so detached or removed from the rest of the project, which can sometimes lead to bad things. I guess in some ways that can be a good thing as well. But it's really interesting hearing from you that you hadn't even been there and that you got to work with them so closely. And this seems sort of to me like it worked out really well. But I imagine there are situations where a voice actor, because they're not going into the studio and they're not working with the dev team every day, might not know as much about the game and the character and might not be able to develop that relationship. It might lead to some, let's call them Peter Dinklage situations, where the voice acting isn't ideal, which is the downside to this whole process. But yeah, but it sounds like you guys had a pretty good thing going on, which is really cool.
Yeah, I think it also helps that like I know games. And having a shorthand, especially for a game like this, is super helpful. Like, I could just see, like, oh, I'm doing this scene three times. I know why. Because this one's the aggressive one. You know what I mean? Like, stuff like that.
Right.
So there was a bit of a shorthand. And what's nice about that is that it kind of lifts some of the technical problems out of the way so that we can focus more on, okay, who is this person? What are we trying to get across in the scene? So most of the conversations that we had, that the back and forth that I would have with my director in particular, were just about like conversations about, you know, I think Aloy should be a bit more aggressive in this moment. Like, I think, you know, there's that scene with Helis. We had, Jamie and I had a lot of conversations about the scene with Helis in the Sun Dome, and about how far we push her and that kind of thing. So the conversations actually ended up being really cool, and they were all about process and finding her emotionally in the moment, and less about like, wait, why am I saying this particular technical right. thing? You know what I mean?
Right,
so
right.
it really was more about performance, and that's what was kind of nice about it. And again, there was sort of a trust thing where it's like, okay, if you say that you need more time on the scene or you want to take it again, we trust you. And then if you're telling me, oh, okay, we got it, we need to move on, I have to yeah. trust you. So there was like an exchange happening there, you know?
Very cool.
So I think we have to wrap things up. Ashley, thank you so much for being here. So people
Thanks
can obviously
me.
Find you in Horizon Zero Dawn. Where else on the internet can people find you?
Where else on the internet? I'm on Twitter. My handle is Ashley_Birch. My name is spelled in a stupid way. So it's Ashley Burch. I'm in Horizon. I'm Chloe in Life is Strange. I have a silly web series with my brother called Hey Ash, What You Playing that we update.
Very enjoyable, which we didn't get a chance to talk about, but it's very funny.
Yeah, we update it once every moon cycle. Yeah, I'm in a Cartoon Network show that's coming out too.
Oh, nice. That's
cool.
exciting.
Mm-hmm, very
which
exciting.
Is cool.
Are you in any other video games that are coming out, or are you not allowed to talk about any?
I'm trying to think if I can talk about
Is there anything
them.
That you can talk about that you're now that you want to plug? Obviously, Horizon's going to have DLC at some point in the future, and we will all be checking out that. But yeah, pleasantly surprising how good that game was and how
Thank
much
you.
I want DLC after finishing it.
Oh, that's great. I'm glad to hear it.
Cool. All right. Well, all right. Thanks, Ashley.
Thank you. Good talking to you guys.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Hey, I'm Melissa Kirsch, editor-in-chief of Lifehacker.
And I'm Alice Bradley, Lifehacker's deputy editor.
And we're the hosts of Lifehacker's podcast, The Upgrade. On The Upgrade, we help you improve your life one week at a time. We talk to guests like former hacker Hector Monsegur about online security.
You need to be aware of how you could be attacked. You need to be aware of what's your weakness.
And Alan Alda on how to communicate more effectively.
And in order to achieve that, we start with teaching exercises derived from improvisation.
And sex therapist Steven Snyder about how to have great sex in a long-term relationship.
What really works under those circumstances is if you enjoy the other person selfishly.
Hey, your life? It's terrible. We can help.
Find The Upgrade wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm psyched to finish Horizon Zero Dawn. I'm going to probably finish that this week, and then we can talk about it. We got all these spoiler casts we need to do. Zelda and the Persona, but I want to talk about the end
I don't know if Horizon needs a spoiler cast. Persona and Zelda certainly do. Yeah, that was fun. Thanks to Ashley for being here. And
yeah, definitely.
Now, before we say goodbye, should we do a couple of reader questions?
Yeah, let's do it. So we got some reader mail based on the conversation you and I were having last week about video games and patching stories and architecture and houses and music and all these other things. So we will read those and discuss them.
I think we should spend another 20 minutes talking about how architecture relates to video games.
I think, clearly that there were plenty of people who thought that was interesting. Our first listener mail comes from Joe Fuller, who writes, "Hi, Jason and Kirk. Whilst listening to your most recent split screen, I had one of those gah, I wish I was in the room moments when you were discussing the problem of art slash product and how many changes are justified, etc. The extended building analogy was funny, and I wanted to offer Kanye West's The Life of Pablo as a good recent example of the elasticity of art. As a music lover, I was spiritually confused when Kanye changed some tracks on the album after it was released. Rather than feeling like it was unfinished or undecided, the label wrote that, quote, in the months to come, Kanye will release new updates, new versions, and new iterations of the album. An innovative, continuous process, the album will be a living, evolving art product, unquote. One could argue that the new models of art being distributed via streaming services or downloads lends itself to creators changing their work more easily and frequently than previous models. For example, one might argue that the different cuts of Nymphomaniac, Grindhouse, or the black and white version of Mad Max Fury Road were quicker off the mark than older director's cuts because they could be released online and on DVD without much fuss." He goes on and he talks about Final Fantasy XV. He agrees with Jason that that changing the story is worrying for the player because you're changing the narrative. He talks about how the Beatles fans would maybe rather that Revolution 9 was removed from the White Album, but that would feel wrong because it wasn't the artist's intention. So do you change it? It's good, and he gives a lot of examples, but I think that Kanye one is fascinating. Mm-hmm. And the idea that because this stuff is digital, it's become so easy to be like, we'll just change it, you know, and it'll be fine. And then it leads to these kind of, you know, significant changes to a work of art, which I thought was kind of interesting.
Yeah, it's I'm not like a Kanye West fan. Have you actually listened to The Life of Pablo?
No, I feel like I should. Kanye is one of those artists who I feel like is really interesting. And if I took more time to just like listen to new music, I would listen to him, but no, I haven't really listened to
him. I think when you get to a certain age, you just stop listening to new music and it's just impossible to listen to
it. Yeah, I mean, I just listen to such different kinds of music now and get something so different out of it. I'm looking for something more specific than just what's the new biggest thing.
Only listen to the Persona 5 soundtrack.
Right, I basically loop that in the Hamilton soundtrack over and over.
But so it is an interesting ongoing question of like how much you should be able to change and what a living piece of art actually means, and whether it hurts the product and hurts the art for it to change. And as we talked to Frank Cifaldi a few weeks ago at GDC about preservation, and this really hurts preservation because when something is changed drastically, there's often no way to actually go back and play and discover the old stuff. So,
right.
Yeah, I mean, it brings
kind of, like the thing of like I think the example, and we mentioned this with Ashley too, is the Peter Dinklage example where there is this. It's not a great performance, but there is this version of Destiny with this whole vocal performance from Peter Dinklage that now is kind of gone to the ravages of time.
Yep.
Because it is interesting. I think that the point that I think Joe's point about how digital media makes this so much easier, it's definitely valid. Like that is one of the things that leads to this kind of thing happening. So yeah. The next letter that dealt with this as well is from Adrian Torres. He wrote some stuff before he got to this, but this is the salient section. He said, "I had this thought as I'm listening to you guys try to elegantly deconstruct that building metaphor that just did not want to work with you. Sorry, Kirk. I suddenly found myself shouting Star Wars. See, George Lucas did the exact thing we're talking about. The infamous Han Solo scene. I won't get into all the other stuff he added, but the infamous Han Solo scene, which what Adrian is referring to here is this is Han shot first. I feel like everybody listening to our list knows this, but the fact that Han used to shoot Greedo first under the table and then George Lucas changed it so that it made it look like Greedo shot and made Han more honorable. Okay, so back to Adrian. He essentially, quote, patched Star Wars, killing the original version, creating an inconsistency in experiences across audiences depending on when you watched. Mm-hmm. So, for example, about a year ago, I found myself explaining this whole Han shot first thing to my 10-year-old son. And like any good father who teaches his son right from wrong, I, of course, taught him that Han shot first. I agree with Jason that this is happening more and more, and while it's hard to quantify what harm will come of it, one thing's for sure, it shouldn't be acceptable. Developers should be apologetic when they have to do that, not taking a this is normal for video games attitude. They should feel like they missed the mark, let fans down, failed to meet their standards, and other shameful terms.
I mean, so, the other side of that coin is Diablo 3, where a game has just changed like constantly for the better over time, and Destiny, yeah, and a lot of these other games.
I think and so one of the things that I was sort of, you know, needling you with last week was just, I think that there sometimes can be a sort of an exceptionalism when talking about video games, where people will be like, oh, well, video games are nothing like anything else, and this has never happened before. But I do think, and it's something that Life of Pablo is true of too, and something you were hitting at when I listened back to our conversation, you're kind of talking about patching story. And I think really, like, when we're talking about games, the idea of patching story and characters and changing the story so that it's different, and changing the ending and changing, like, whole character interactions, that's like Han shot first. That's definitely more questionable, right? That's more obviously questionable, because the actual story of the thing is being changed after some people have already finished it.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess so. I was trying to think. So the other... I mean, the problem that I was bringing up last week isn't just the way that it changes the experience. It's that you're getting a better game. So, like, we were talking about the animations getting fixed. And one of the problems with that is that one of the points that I was making last week is that if it feels like games are not going to be finished or fixed or improved until months after launch, then why would anyone buy a game on launch day anymore? And
which
that's becoming
then will
stupider
lead
and stupider.
To people not buying games. And
right.
That
I think that is, so it's like two concerns almost. One of them is the story and the, I guess, ethical questions or artistic questions over whether story should be changed post-release.
And yeah, like, what is the integrity of the story? And is your story, does it have integrity, or are you just going to change it if people tell you they don't like it?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting question, and there's no easy answer to that. I don't want to act like there's a right or wrong answer. But the other problem, the problem of games being improved, it's like, that's another tough question, because you want developers to be able to improve their games after launch and fix their games after launch. I was having this conversation with someone on Twitter, I think, about Mass Effect or something.
Was it someone with a Scorpio
logo
in their name?
I probably would have blocked them. Not that PlayStation fans aren't as bad. Like, PlayStation fans are just as bad.
No, it's cool. We don't have to get sidetracked on Twitter fans anymore.
Anyway, talking to someone on Twitter, and they were like, well, if this were the old days 20 years ago, then the bug would have just stayed in the game to never be fixed. But it's almost like, I don't know. Like, I wonder if it's really such a good thing that that games can be patched and bugs can be removed, because, first of all, it allows developers to say, oh, we'll put this in the day one patch. Or we'll get this out after launch. And second of all, it just creates this world where buying games on day one is just a sucker's bet, and it's just not worth it. And why would I want to play the game with the face is tired lady in Mass Effect whose eyes are rolling all over the place?
Yeah, when 2 weeks later, she'll look a lot better. Yeah.
So it's just such a tough question, and it's such a tough industry problem, because eventually we're going to get to this point where nobody wants to buy games on launch day anymore.
Right.
And man, what's the answer? There is no answer.
Yeah, it's almost like games, like, we'll just maybe start thinking of games more as these ongoing processes and less as these boxed products that you
they
buy.
They have like to be, just, I guess.
They basically are that already. I mean, even these single-player games like Mass Effect that you would think of that way are kind of this in-process thing. Yeah, I don't know. It just is, it's an evolving, complicated question.
Yeah, I mean, it sits up there with, like, the, is there room for big single player games anymore, and is there room for, like, one shot games where you just play them once, and all of these questions facing the industry. And I don't know, I'm worried that it's all going to come to a point where, like, it feels like this has gotten worse and worse over the past 2 years, and Destiny and The Division and Diablo 3 and all of these other games, it feels like there's a giant list, like an ever expanding list. And actually, this is to get into plug mode for a second, this is something that I touched upon a little bit in my book, because one of the things that I talk a lot about is that it's so hard to make these games that at the point where you actually finish them, that's the point where you really feel like you understand the game, and then you can go back and be like, oh, we gotta fix the pacing here, we gotta fix these bugs, we gotta, like, make it so purple engrams don't drop blue loot half the time. And it's like, once it's out there in the wild and you're playing it and people are playing it, that's when you can really identify these problems. But because everything doesn't coalesce until the very last minute, there's no way to really recognize those problems.
Yeah, it's something I even thought about when we were talking to Datto last week, about how when Destiny came out, this sort of question of how many people at Bungie really play Destiny hardcore. And then again, like, the flip side of that is, before Destiny came out, there kind of probably wasn't a Destiny to play hardcore. until the very last minute, so they couldn't even, they couldn't know what it would be like to play it, just because it wasn't even finished.
Right. There's I mean, my understanding is that a lot of the mission structure itself, that some that part and the missions getting, I mean, because of the way Destiny was made and because everything was torn apart in the last year of development, there was nothing like that. But you could go in there and play with the sandbox and shoot things and like get a feel for the game and that sort of thing. So,
but we were talking about the experience of leveling up to 20 and grinding to 26, and how can you even have that experience? Like, and I think that's probably true of a lot of games, right? I mean, that's just one example, but you just can't, you can't know. And so then it comes out, and then you have all these people playing it, telling you all this stuff, and then you're even able to play it and say, "Oh yeah, that's true." I mean, even Ashley talking about, "Oh, sometimes I'll hear lines back and say, oh, okay, that was not how I thought it was going to be." You just don't know until you see this finished thing. That's just the one of the side effects of a massive collaborative creative undertaking. I don't know if there's any way around that.
Well, I mean, but that's the question. Like, for consumers, like, what does your average gamer care about whether a game is made at the last minute or not? I mean, it's interesting, but I'm saying, like, from I'm giving you $60 for this game perspective, it doesn't matter to me when how much the developers played it. It just matters to me that I have a good game.
Of course. I'm saying if the developers play it a lot, they'll probably be able to make it better, and then you'll get a good game.
My point is that, like, because these games are getting so much more complicated, and because we're at the point where these games aren't coalescing until as close to the last possible minute as possible, it's going to create problems if it's not already creating problems. I mean, we already saw a string of games that came out and nobody bought on release day, or like sold poorly on release day, like Dishonored 2 and Watch Dogs 2.
Titanfall 2.
Yeah. And there are a lot of factors there. Don't get me wrong. It's not just because of this, but I think one of the reasons is that nobody wants to buy games on launch anymore. Some games they do. Some games have done well on launch, but it just feels like there's more of a malaise than there was. And
as long as that continues to be true, that it's not a good idea to buy games on day one, that'll be true.
And how can we in good conscience recommend that people buy any game on launch unless we played it and it's as incredible as Zelda or
I would recommend people buy Zelda at launch. I mean, there's still games that come out that are good at launch. It's not every game, it's just some. And even Watch Dogs 2, Titanfall 2, well, Dishonored 2 needed a patch on PC, but it was okay. I mean, all three of those games didn't have the problem you're talking about. All three of them were not patched to be better afterwards. They all actually released.
No, I know,
fine.
I know.
Watch Dogs
I know.
2 played great. Titanfall 2 played great.
That's not my point. My point is more that gamers have become kind of disillusioned after buying games like at launch, and they're broken and busted and have all sorts of problems. I think it's becoming more of a world where people are just more and more skeptical about buying games at launch versus waiting
good.
To buy.
They should be. But
On one hand, yes, of course, gamers should be smarter consumers, and everyone should wait and get discounts and all that. Like, we should all value our money. But as far as an industry perspective, if the industry continues to be reliant on people buying games on launch and pre-ordering, and people don't want to do that anymore, then we have problems. So it doesn't lead to some sort of crash or
right. And the question of, I mean, and usually crashes are like the kind of thing you're envisioning are related to more than just one factor. Like, there are multiple things building, which there could
another
well be
economic
forces. Another
factor could be oversaturation.
Yeah, and there could be other just like more global economic forces, again, with like video game exceptionalism fighting against that. Like, video games don't exist in a vacuum. They're an industry, a giant entertainment industry that exists in the world economy. The world economy itself has a million different things influencing it. So there are a lot of things that could lead to that kind of thing.
Sure.
Or the industry could just adjust to this new way of doing things, and over time we just see a kind of new way to emerge. We'll have to see.
So on that note, on that lovely note, let's call it quits for today.
We can call it quits.
Thank you again to Ashley Birch for being on the show. And I think that's it. We'll see you next week.
Kotaku Split Screen is the official podcast of Kotaku.com. It's produced by Jason Schreier and me, Kirk Hamilton. I edit and mix the podcast and also wrote and performed our theme song and other music. You can find us on popular podcast services like Panoply, NPR Now, Google Play, and iTunes, where we hope you'll leave us a review if you like what you hear. Find old episodes at Kotaku.com/splitscreen. Email us at splitscreen@Kotaku.com.